Thank you. Lois? I had an argument with Beebe last night in his dressing room, and the issue was who was more nervous about appearing here today. And I have the feeling I'm about to win the argument. Perhaps I should begin by telling about the occasion when I first heard B.B. King play. It was 1968, and the occasion was somewhat unusual. The stage was situated on the pitcher's mound in Fenway Park, which is the baseball stadium here in Boston. And the night was a rally for McCarthy for president, and there was a program of music. Now, I came for the music, not for the politics, because I had been waiting for 2 years to hear B.B. King play recordings as early as 1966, and had read a bit about him and heard a lot of gossip, which gave me the image of a mysterious character who was renowned to be the master of the instrument, but who was not easy to find or see. But I had seen advertisements for him playing in Boston, and he appeared in those 2 years between the time that I discovered his music and first heard him in Fenway Park, at least a few times in a place called Louis Showcase Lounge, which was situated in Roxbury. And in all candor, I have to tell you that I was simply too frightened to go to a club in Roxbury to hear B.B. King. Now, I mention this because I think it's suggestive of something which I found most interesting about B.B.'s story, and that is that I think his emergence as a popular figure in white middle America was connected with the social changes which were taking place in the country during that time. But the episode may be a little bit misleading because this setting that I describe of a political rally for what you'd have to call an American dissident associated with the anti-war movement and with its first cousin, the civil rights movement, may give you the impression that the social changes that I have in mind are the political changes which came from the civil rights movement, and that's not the case. In fact, the message which I'd like to get across is that the social changes which set the stage for the arrival of B.B. King in the late 1960s were much subtler and much deeper than the changes which came about in our society because of the accomplishments of the civil rights movement of the early 60s. And I'd like to try to describe briefly what I think those changes were and what the background was. Now, to do that, I'd like to go back a bit and give you a little bit of the history of black American music. When I began researching the subject as a result of my interest in B.B.'s music, it came as something of a shock to me to discover that prior to 1956, a majority of music made by black Americans in the United States was completely inaccessible to white Americans. Prior to 1956, a date which is significant because that is the date I fixed roughly as the birth of rock and roll, black American music, it seems to me, could be described as having three rough categories. There was jazz on one side, there was gospel on another side, and there was everything else in between. And it was this loose collection of music that stood between these two well-defined and respectable styles of music, gospel and jazz, which were known to white America. It was this middle ground in which B.B.'s music was situated, and it was this middle ground of music which I discovered had been completely inaccessible to white America. And this came as something of a shock to me. This middle ground of music was called generally rhythm and blues, and that too is a little bit misleading because the label rhythm and blues is still around, but I think it's changed its meaning somewhere. Another word which was used to describe this music as an economic commodity, as a music industry, was a term which is not heard very often nowadays, and that is the term race music. And it was called race music precisely because of its great isolation within an economic and cultural and social sphere which was in a kind of bubble in the middle of America. And that bubble was black America, and outside it stood the rest of middle America, and there seemed to be no exchange, at least as far as these kinds of music, which then were called very roughly rhythm and blues. So great was the isolation that the business of marketing this kind of music was called Race Records. That was the record industry. and the economic trace lines of this business were completely contained within the black communities of the United States. The record shops were located in black neighborhoods. Very often the records were not sold in record shops at all, but sold in grocery stores or barber shops or shoeshine stands. And I'm trying to convey to you the image of this music as being economically as well as socially and artistically really very much isolated in the middle of our country, and the rest of what we think of as American, middle America, being oblivious to it. Then in 1956, there was a very dramatic change in popular culture in America, and that was the birth of rock and roll. And I picture the birth of rock and roll as really the birth of twins. One of the twins came from country and western and hillbilly music, and in the early days often carried the label rockabilly. And the best known rockabilly artist was Elvis Presley. But there are many others, and I would mention Buddy Holly just to give you one example. The other twin came from this loose collection of music in the middle, somewhere between gospel and jazz, which had been called for a long time rhythm and blues. And out of this came a kind of slice of this music which moved into our popular culture, and it included artists like Little Richard, Fats Domino, Chuck Berry, Lloyd Price, Jackie Wilson, and many, many others. So this happened in the mid-50s. The tragedy, I think, of the story is that from this time, when this music was exported to Middle America, until the late 60s, the core of this music, in fact, the music which I think had the highest artistic merit, which was the purest strain of this music, music which is typified by Beebe's music, this music was left behind. And the last color barriers which had surrounded music, black music, first around jazz, and then around rhythm and blues, and then finally around blues. This was the last kind of island. And in the middle of this island stood stranded this man, B.B. King. What I would like to try to explain is the fact that it seems to me that the changes which were necessary in our society to make B.B.'s emergence even possible were very subtle changes, much deeper than the kind of institutional changes which were involved in the civil rights struggle. The civil rights struggle made concrete changes in our institutions, and I think that they're remarkable accomplishments for our country, but they are on a level closer to the surface and more conspicuous than the kinds of changes which set the stage for B.B.'s arrival. What was required for B.B.'s arrival was a change of mentality of our country. It was an emergence of a new kind of tolerance. B.B.'s success, I think, had a kind of reinforcement with these changes in our society, in the sense that I don't think if the changes hadn't started prior to this, B.B.'s emergence would have been possible. But on the other hand, if B.B. hadn't been a remarkably durable character and a very persistent fellow who was dedicated to the idea that his music should be accepted and should become respectable, I don't think that he would have succeeded even despite the changes which set the stage. Being a persistent fellow who really made a kind of personal crusade that his music should become respectable, he made an enormous contribution to this subtler change in the social infrastructure, which I'm trying to call your attention to. So I think there was a kind of mutually reinforcing phenomena in which the possibility of an opening presented itself, and through this opening came B.B. And he broke open the color barriers which had, until that time, confined the last, the purest, the most artistically meritorious strain of this music, which had been for so long confined. And I would mention one other incident to try to show you the contrast between what I'm describing as these institutional changes and the deeper social changes. And that's the incident when the son of Ralph Bunche, the distinguished American diplomat, was refused admission to a country club because of his race. Neither Bunche nor his son made any efforts to overturn this. And I think that they were in the right, because it was a private club. And as regrettable as it is that there should be private clubs who are determined to keep people out because of their color or their religion or whatever, the kind of change which is necessary for society to be more tolerant is not, for this sort of change, is not an institutional change, but it's a change of mentality and a change of attitude. And appreciation of music like Bibi's is the kind of phenomena which breaks down the intolerance and the rigidity of society, so that cases like the celebrated case of Ralph Bunche's son are now, fortunately, quite rare. That's more or less the message of my book. So perhaps I should say a few words about the story of the publication of my book, because I know that some of you have written books and some of you are writing books, and so the sociology of the publication industry may be of a little bit of interest to you. I began trying to find a publisher for a biography of B.B. King in 1972, and as early as 1972 I had something I could call a manuscript to show to publishers. Between 1972 and 1978 I collected 35 rejections for the B.B. King story. In 1978, I signed a contract with Macmillan for a publication of the B.B. King story. The manuscript went through three drafts and was approved by the editor and sent off to the copy editor. I didn't realize it at the time, but the editor had a hidden agenda, and I discovered it when the copy-edited manuscript came back rewritten. The first page of the new manuscript was page 489 of the old manuscript. I won't inflict on you the details of the struggle that came after this, but I can tell you they weren't very pleasant. Eventually, within a few months' time and some tough sessions, I agreed, my publisher, Macmillan, agreed that we would part company. I wish I could say it was amicably, but it wasn't. At least it was legally clean. I can say that much for it. Then I was in the situation of having a much refined, much deeper, much expanded, and much more polished manuscript and a collection of over 100 photographs to go with it. And I took this back out to the marketplace. And in 6 months' time, I collected an additional 18 rejections, at which time I signed a contract with Doubleday. And I have very amicable relations with Doubleday. I was fortunate to find an editor who was very sympathetic, with whom I had very good relations, and I was pleased in every respect with the editorial work and with the production values of the book. Now, I tell this story not to discourage you, but rather to encourage you. It's a fact that the publication business has a lot of hard knocks in it. I think some of the difficulties that I had in finding a publisher, and I know that some of the difficulties I had with my first publisher, came over the fact that my idea of how to write such a story was unorthodox by the canons of the publishing industry, how one writes a book about a popular entertainer. And so, really, my message for this little digression is that if you have an idea that's unorthodox, you can expect resistance. But I think it's worth the trouble to try to push, because you may very well meet with success. And even if you don't, you'll have an interesting journey. So, now I think I should tell you just a few biographical details about Bibi, and then I'll introduce him. Bibi King was born Riley B. King in 1925 on a plantation near Itabena, Mississippi. His parents were sharecroppers, which means that they worked the land of a landlord who shared with them one half of the gross receipts from the sale of the crop that they raised on his land. It was a particularly nasty institution. It kept people permanently in debt, and the only thing which they had as collateral was their labor. And it reminds me of a blues lyric from a Robert Johnson tune, which describes the emotional bondage of a man for a woman, but the same bondage applied for sharecroppers to their landlords. And the line is, "She's got a mortgage on my body and a lien on my soul." And that's the way things stood for sharecroppers, because the only collateral they had was to say, "I'm not going anywhere," even if they wanted to. But by the age of five, Riley B. King's parents were divorced. By the age of 9, his mother had died, and by the age of 14, his grandmother had died, which left him at that point, for all practical purposes, an orphan, because his father was in parts unknown. So at age 14, alone, he was living in Kilmichael, Mississippi, sharecropping on 1 acre of cotton and living on an allowance of $2.50 from the landlord. This, I'm sure, sounds very harsh, and there is something very harsh about it, but I want to discourage you from getting a very negative picture of the landlord himself, who is a man that I met, who had a great deal of affection for Bibi, and I think even today their relations are amicable. I encourage you to read my appendix in which I describe meeting this landlord. In any case, he wasn't a Simon Legree, is what I mean to say. By contrast, 10 years later, B.B. King was making $2,500 a week in the early 1950s as a very popular entertainer on the Chitlin' Circuit, which was the circuit of nightclubs where race music was performed. From that time, say from the mid-50s until the late 1960s, he was a celebrity in black America and virtually unknown in white America. So great was the isolation of blues music during this time that even as late as 1965, a sociologist named Charles Kyle, who wrote a very scholarly book and a very readable book, which I recommend highly, called Urban Blues, wrote in 1965 in his chapter about B.B. King, probably not more than 5,000 white people in the United States know B.B. King's name, and the chances that this is going to change are very small. Fortunately, he was wrong. Since B.B.'s emergence in white America, he's had many triumphs. He's known well not only in the United States, but worldwide. He's a very popular artist in Japan and Australia. He's appeared in Israel. He's had a tour of Africa. He's had several tours of Europe, and now tours practically annually in Europe. And he had a triumphant tour in 1978 of the Soviet Union. He was awarded an honorary Doctor of Music degree from Tougaloo College in Tougaloo, Mississippi, and an honorary Doctor of Music degree from Yale University. And I don't mean to rub it in, but Harvard is coming in second at recognizing B.B. King. I have a picture in the book which shows B.B. standing beside Kingman Brewster, who was the president of Yale at the time. He's now ambassador to Great Britain. And they're both standing in their academic regalia with their mortar boards. And it was the day B.B. received his honorary Ph.D. And I get enormous kicks out of showing the picture to people and seeing them look at the picture and say, who's the white man beside B.B.? I think that's enough from me. B.B. has consented to give a kind of demonstration to actually make some music for us and to talk and to answer questions. And I think it's best now if we just take a short intermission, because some of B.B.'s musicians are here, and it will take us just a few minutes to make the necessary preparations.
Yeah. I'm really not that used to it now, but it's going to be all right.